Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast, where you learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secured retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in, because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fund. I'm the Big Mike. I'm Mike Zlotnik. And I have the privilege and honor to have Jason Hartman with me today. He's a good friend and a brilliant marketer, really brilliant real estate investor. And he has an awesome podcast himself called The Creating Wealth Show. And it's a privilege to have you here, Jason. Welcome.
Hey, Mike. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you coming on board. Let's chat about what's going on in the world today. You are the Master Blaster, if you remember that good old movie, about Master Blaster of single-family, SFR, single-family residential investment. Right. You sell close to 1,000 houses a year, investment properties to investors like me who live in the coastal markets and they buy all over the country. Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about that market? What is it that you do, and how come this is such an exciting area of investing?
Yeah, it really is an incredibly exciting area. I've been in this business since 2004, so I've got probably some of the longest experience in the nationwide investment business of anybody out there. And then I've been in the real estate business for a long, long time, in the traditional real estate business before that. And it is an amazing time right now. The thing that is really happening that is extremely significant for your viewers and listeners, Mike, is the GOP tax plan, originally the Trump tax plan, and now morphed into GOP tax plan, and that is going to be extremely significant for real estate investors. It is fantastic news. It hurts some people, it helps others. It hurts people who own expensive homes, usually in coastal markets. You mentioned on my intro that our investors were from the coastal markets. They're really from all over the world. American real estate is very appealing to a global audience of real estate investors. But a lot of our investors definitely are from the West Coast and the East Coast, the more expensive real estate markets. And what they're going to find is that the government is now disincentivizing homeownership of high-end homes. So that is going to incentivize real estate investing, because it's one of the few sacred cows where people can still get tremendous tax benefits. Income property has always been the most tax-favored asset class in America and the most historically proven investment class in the entire world. And what we're going to see here, Mike, is we're going to see huge incentives for entrepreneurs and real estate investors. We'll see the corporate tax rate drop down to, I think, 21%. It looks like it's going to be the final number, down from 35%. So that'll be a huge incentive. There's incentives to repatriate money that is hidden offshore. There are incentives for real estate investors and disincentives for upscale homeowners, as I mentioned. They're going to be hurt. And so one of the things I've always said to people is that if you are living in a property worth more than $250,000, and I don't mean to say that's a high-end home, it obviously depends where you're talking about, but $250,000 is about the number where it starts to really beg the question, should I be renting this home rather than owning it? We all need a place to live. A home is always a liability. It is never an investment. People are fooled into thinking it's an investment because sometimes out of every 10 years or so, there's a hot market where they make a lot of money on appreciation. But that's luck. That's not investing. That's speculation. If it happened to you, fantastic, good for you, congratulations, but it's not something reliable. Our investors are very conservative. They invest for yield, they invest for cash flow, and that is true investing, kind of the Warren Buffett ideology, but applied to a better asset class, to income property.
Jason, this is very, very interesting stuff. I appreciate you taking the time to explain this. I'm a big fan of investment property, and living in New York City, it's a little bit of a different play. Most people buy here $1 million plus properties, not because they are investing, but because they need to live somewhere.
Right. And, but they'd be much better off renting those properties. So let me give you an example, Mike. One of our rule of thumb, okay, metrics is the very simple rent to value ratio, or the RV ratio. People have used this metric and said this before, but I sort of calculated a much simpler way than most. And what we do is we simply look at the value of the property versus the rent. So $1 million property in New York City can be rented for approximately, give or take, $4,000 per month.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing how these ratios hold up worldwide. We can be talking about Paris, London, Hong Kong, Dubai, New York, Miami, Los Angeles, Seattle, San Francisco, anywhere on the planet, the ratios are about the same. And that's not good enough for us as investors. As investors, we want to get somewhere in the ballpark of 1% of the value per month. So $1 million worth of real estate, we would like to get, we would like to see you get $10,000 per month for that $1 million invested. So if you can rent a $1 million property and you need a place to live, rent it for $4,000 a month and arbitrage that investment by taking that $1 million real estate portfolio and buying 10 single family homes in three diverse markets around the country for $100,000 each and get $10,000 per month of income while you arbitrage and rent the home in which you live for only $4,000. That's a great deal. And now that deal got even better under the GOP or Trump tax plan because they have further incentivized owning that $1 million home in New York City. Or $1 million one-bedroom condo or studio condo, I should say, not home.
Yes.
You don't get much in New York City for $1 million.
You can get a nice closet.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I was generous in saying it might be a one-bedroom or a studio. You know, it depends where, obviously.
It depends where, yeah. What's interesting is the Trump tax plan and the reduction of the deductibility of real estate taxes and interest on the mortgage
interest, yeah.
Yeah, will significantly reduce the demand potentially for these high-end properties, and they shouldn't create the opposite effect on the income property. So I agree with you. Let's talk a little bit more about what are the basic benefits of, just very quickly, basic benefits of income property investments. The four major benefits, as far as I know, of real estate is the appreciation, depreciation, amortization, and what am I missing?
Oh, well,
and cash flow.
Mortgage payoff, cash flow, depreciation as a tax benefit, but appreciation as a investment benefit or capital gains benefit. So yeah, income property is the most historically proven asset class in the world, Mike. And that what I like to tell people is that it's a multi-dimensional asset class. Right. Other investments, you know, most investments are single dimension, one dimensional, where you're simply buy low, sell high. That's the whole game.
Well, New York. All coastal markets, yeah. You buy for appreciation. 90% of your gain comes from the appreciation, for sure.
No question. But in a non-dividend paying stock or a cryptocurrency or precious metals, that's all true too, okay? It's a single dimension asset class, one dimensional. And one dimensional is highly risky, highly speculative, because there's only one way to make money from appreciation. That's it. And if it goes the other way, you're obviously going to lose money. Then the second class would be the two dimensional asset classes, like a dividend paying stock. You get some dividends along the way and hopefully appreciation. So buy low, sell high, get dividends. Income property is multidimensional. There are actually many dimensions: appreciation, depreciation tax benefit, cash flow, mortgage pay down. And something unique to my investing education is what I call inflation-induced debt destruction. So beyond the other things we mentioned and beyond one more thing we didn't even mention is leverage. So you get to leverage that appreciation because you only have to buy, say, 20% of that asset with your own money. The rest comes from the bank. So you've got a very vested interest partner that's putting up 80% of the capital. You can do five times more than you can with pretty much any other investment.
Let me jump on this.
Is very good like that, yeah.
It's a very brilliant way to put it, multi-dimensional asset class. So you mentioned two things that I wanted to briefly chat about. One is a cryptocurrency world. One-dimensional appreciation. And then the second thing I wanted to ask you, what do you think about the interest rate increases that Janet Yellen has communicated to the financial markets? What do you think the interest rate increases will do to the prices of investment properties.
Well, interest rates have been artificially low for far too long, and they need to go up. Okay, so I'm in favor of some reasonable, measured interest rate increases. Now, remember, the Fed doesn't directly control mortgage rates, as you know, but indirectly they do. You know, their change sort of influences the entire market. So we're going to see. We saw one interest rate increase just last week. The Fed says that they will have three more next year. And two more after that. Now, one of the beautiful things about income property is that, number one, many people are winning when they don't even know. They feel like they're losing, but they're winning because they don't know how to keep score. They don't know how to do the math of income property. So that's one thing I want to say right out of the gate. But the other thing to say is I teach something I call the three dimensions of real estate. And there are really more dimensions than that. But what we see in low interest rate environments is we typically see rents that don't go up as much as they should. Now, rents historically always go up. Rent is always higher. It always increases, right, when you rent a property. And so the rent, if you're a landlord, if you're an owner, you want to see rent increases. And when interest rates are low, people are motivated to buy for many reasons. Number one, they have the fear of loss or FOMO, fear of missing out. They don't want to miss out on the market because prices are appreciating so quickly. They feel like that if we don't buy a home now in which to live, we're never going to get in, right? We're just going to keep getting less and less for our money. So when we see low interest rates, it sucks a lot of people out of the rental market and pushes them into the buying pool.
That's right.
But what we see in higher interest rate environments is we see, number one, we see fewer investors buying because they're priced out of the market with higher rates. So the supply of rental housing declines, which is good news for existing owners. But also we see rents go up because a lot of those people that would otherwise be motivated to buy become less motivated to buy, either psychologically or because they just can't qualify for loans because housing affordability declines. So as landlords, we love higher interest rates because we've got our three-decade-long fixed rate investment grade mortgages with artificially low interest rates locked in. I mean, you know, if someone purchases a property today, it'll be 2027, 2037, 2047 before they make the last payment on that mortgage, or really their tenant makes the last payment on the mortgage. Because when we use debt on income properties, Mike, we don't pay our own debts. We outsource our debts to people called tenants. The tenants pay the loans for us, and they pay them back in ever depreciating dollars over time. This is a unique thing that I teach that other educators don't teach. I call it inflation-induced debt destruction. Now, that's a mouthful. Try and say it 10 times fast. Inflation-induced debt destruction.
Inflation-induced debt destruction. I got it, but it's a brilliant way to put it.
It's a tongue twister, I tell you.
It is.
And Mike, let me give you an example. You know, this is not some esoteric concept, some theory. This has really happened to tens of millions of people in the U.S. and many more millions around the world. So I'll give you an example of someone who actually purchased a home in which to live in 1972. Now, why do I pick 1972? Because 1 year before that, something very significant happened. Nixon closed the gold window. Yeah. We finally completely detached from a gold standard in 1971. And in the middle of 1972, the typical interest rate on a three-decade-long fixed-rate mortgage was 7.37%, 7.37 in 1972. Now, someone who bought the median price home, and I'm going to round off here, for approximately $18,000. I know, that's crazy. Can't even buy a good car for that anymore, much less many other things. I mean, that's the cost of a vacation for many people, right?
Right.
So $18,000 for the median price home in 1972 at a 7.37% mortgage. So if they put 20% down, their mortgage would be in the ballpark of $14,000 and change, okay? Now, they would get this mortgage and they would pay it for three decades. So by 2001, when they made the last payment on that mortgage, the dollar that in 1972 was worth $1, right. In 2001, 30 years later, that same dollar was only worth 24 cents.
But you know what's interesting? That's a phenomenal point. But it feels like the real estate prices are appreciated faster than the rate of inflation of a dollar.
They do. So you double arbitrage. The dollar deflates and you pay back your debts in ever cheaper dollars.
That's right.
This is what I call inflation-induced debt destruction. So over the course of the three decades that these millions of people, not a theory, an actual fact, that these millions of people owned their single-family homes, the homes in which they lived. Now, keep in mind, this equation is dramatically better for an income property investor, because the example I'm giving is someone who paid their own debt. If it was an income property, your tenant paid your debt for you. So it's unbelievable how much better it gets then. But say you're paying your own debt. You actually, at the end of this equation, let me just tell you how the story turns out. The $1972 dollar is now worth 24 cents in 2001, okay? Right. And the person borrowed $14,000. They thought they were paying 7.37% interest. But at the end of the day, after making all those payments for three decades, they actually got paid to borrow the money, Mike. They got paid after interest and tax deductions, okay? They got paid 1.6% to borrow the money. They got paid to borrow.
Yeah.
Okay. If that was an income property, it would have been even better. So not only did you get the advantage of inflation-induced debt destruction, you got a property, the commodities of that property appreciating typically at faster than the rate of general inflation. Not always. It depends. That'll vary over time. But historically, that's the way it works. So it's the most historically proven asset class in the entire world because it's multidimensional. We talked earlier about the three dimensions of real estate, Mike. When interest rates go up, it pushes upward pressure on rents, right?
That's correct.
You just change your strategy. Sometimes you're in a capital gains environment where rates are low, housing affordability is high, and prices are appreciating dramatically. Then you can just take some gains and win the typical way that people think you win, by taking advantage of capital appreciation. But other times, you can increase your yield on the property dramatically because the rents are going up quickly. So, you know, you adjust your strategy based on what's going on in the market, but there's always a way to make money with income property.
Well, Jason, that was great. I appreciate it. This was a brilliant explanation. Thank you for sharing that. Let's talk a little bit about something that you mentioned, and it is extremely popular today, cryptocurrencies.
Yes.
We're laughing about it, Bitcoin craze, Bitcoin mania.
Welcome to the tulip bubble.
Yes. What's interesting is I have friends on both sides of the aisle. I have we have mutual friends.
Right.
Big time Bitcoin investors, and
they're not investors. They are gamblers and speculators and cult members.
Probably are. It boggles your mind when a Bitcoin was $1,000 at the beginning of the year, and
or when it was $30 back in the old days.
Yeah, it's been appreciating at an absolutely crazy rate. And what's most astonishing is you talk to these people, they think that this thing will continue. So I had a couple of friends who projected that the Bitcoin will go up 350 times within 3 to 5 years. So,
wow.
But that's a contrast to value investing in real estate versus the craze. So here's my theory on this, and I'll give you 2 cents on this. And I may be wrong, and only the time will prove, but I think there will be crypto 2.0, which will significantly devalue current crypto. And it might become in the form of somewhat regulatory environment, and it might come in the form of improved technology. It might come in the form of just natural evolution of a mix of technology, regulation, and people coming to realize that Bitcoin is not gold. Mm-hmm. So the latest I heard is Bitcoin is digital gold, and Litecoin is a digital silver. So That's what they like to call.
Yeah, that's a reasonable thing. I wonder where Christ Coin fits in. That's another one I interviewed someone on my podcast about. They've got a religious cryptocurrency. What about Kanye Coin? Kanye West used to have his own coin. I mean, there's like a new coin every day now. Everybody's doing what's called ICOs, initial coin offerings, versus IPOs. And folks, I got to tell you something. One of the big pitches of why Bitcoin, for example, is so great is there's only 21 million of them, right? So there's a limited supply, unlike the dollar or the yen or the euro that are fiat currency. They're not backed by anything. Let me tell you something. If you think that, you're an idiot, okay? They are backed by something. Yeah, you're right. They're not backed by gold. That bothers me too. Listen, I will be the first to say I want to be wrong about everything I'm about to say about cryptocurrencies. I want to be wrong, okay? But I don't think I'm going to be wrong. Here's the way this looks. Number one, the US dollar is backed by something. It's backed by aircraft carriers, intercontinental ballistic missiles, nuclear warheads, standing armies, the biggest military the human race has ever known. If you think the dollar is not backed by something, you're out of your tree. Okay, you're just out of your mind. Okay, number one. Number two, cryptocurrencies certainly don't have limited supply. Maybe Bitcoin does. Sure, that's fine. But, you know, someone creates a new coin every other day now, right? So there's lots of cryptocurrencies out there in which to invest.
Yeah, okay. Thousands of ICOs. And by the way, half of them are illegal. If you think about it, they are offering sort of a security or something that looks like a security, acts like a security, walks like a security. Yeah, yeah. But not called a security. Right. Their strength is that they do it outside of the U.S. jurisdiction, but it's semi-illegal.
Mike, that is a great point. You know, this is the thing. Look, there was recently an article I saw last week of a woman somewhere back east who sent $80,000 worth of Bitcoin to ISIS, okay? You know, they will find a reason. Look, the major product of any government and any central bank, their widget, their product, if you will, what they sell is currency. That is their thing. It's their product. Listen, if you have all the power of a government or a central bank, the most powerful forces the human race has ever known, are you just going to stand by idly and let competition come in and steal your lunch, okay, and take your market? No way. They're going to find, and they've got lots of reasons and excuses to shut this down, to regulate it, to do something. I mean, you know, people are losing money because a lot of these Bitcoin wallets steal their money, or, you know, they go out of business, you can't find them, whatever. There's those problems, okay? There's the terrorist problem, the drug trade, the Silk Road story. You know, there are a million excuses for governments and central banks to put the kibosh on these things. The crypto 2.0, the one that's going to work, is the one that is, you know, the new fiat currency backed by the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve. That's the one that's going to win. Yeah, they might use the blockchain. They might use some characteristics, which are really neat, some great technologies of these cryptocurrencies, but it's going to be their thing, the thing they run, the thing they control. You know, they're not going to just stand by they're doing it now, but at some point, it's going to be just squashed like a bug, okay? You know, through either additional regulation that's just going to mellow the whole thing out and suck the opportunity away from people, or just completely make it illegal. Okay, you know, they can do anything they want. People have to understand that. And then the argument will be, well, you know, Jason, they can't do that because it's decentralized. I don't know if they can make it illegal. Well, listen, drugs are a commodity. Illegal drugs, they're decentralized. I mean, cocaine is small, valuable, and portable. Okay, people could trade in cocaine, but guess what? It's illegal. You'll go to prison if you use it or trade in it. That makes the market very small. Yeah, we all saw Scarface, the movie. Some people will trade in it, I agree, but it's going to be a small number if it's illegal, okay?
Yeah, that's very interesting observation. I concur with you on many fronts, and I think of the most of the cryptocurrencies.
And I would love to be wrong. I want to be wrong about everything I said, by the way, because I would love nothing more than for someone to come in and displace fiat currencies. Understand, I want to be wrong. I hope I'm wrong.
You know what's interesting? People who have made tremendous amount of money on Bitcoin, they need to wake up, and probably many of them will start diversification. And I looked at the Bitcoin price. The curve is extremely inelastic.
Oh my God, that curve is nuts. It's psychotic. It's what Al Gore said would happen with global warming, now called climate change, that hockey stick, right?
Yeah, anyway, let's switch the subject. It's an exciting subject to talk about. After comparing that to real estate, it's exactly the opposite. It's a one-time play. Yeah. Catch the momentum and hope you're right and get out before the thing turns around.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about what are you investing in? What do you like besides single family residential investment properties?
My favorite thing, Mike, is definitely single family homes. That's my favorite thing. Now, I like a couple other asset classes of real estate, but they're all housing. I like apartments and mobile home parks also. I like housing when you're in the real estate world. Housing. Single family homes being my favorite because they're the simplest and the most reliable and the most conservative. And they really have so many great aspects to them. They're the most debt friendly, lender friendly. Banks love to lend on them, et cetera, et cetera. After that, for simplicity's sake, I like hard money lending. And I do a lot of hard money lending with you and your company.
Thank you.
A lot of money to hard money lend, and thank you for bringing me deals. You guys do a great job of you know, doing due diligence and really just making it easy. So I really appreciate that. I like hard money lending. It isn't multidimensional. It's only one dimensional. It's just yield only. But it is simple and it's convenient, and you know, it doesn't take as much time as doing a real estate deal. So I like it for that purpose. And then I also like businesses. You know, I like entrepreneurship. I like investing money in my own businesses. I have several businesses, and they're just fun and interesting. And some of them are becoming like passion projects for me. I find with a business, you can influence the world, influence the marketplace, and it's fun to do that.
I'm a big fan of hard money lending. Obviously, been doing it for a long time. I find it amazing comparing what we do. We do a hard money loan and charge 12% interest rates for a six-month fix and flip project at the, let's just say, 70% loan-to-value ratio. And we're secured by both a good borrower and a good asset with a good exit strategy. And compare that to the government-subsidized long-term loans, especially FHA, at 4%, 4.5%. It's a government giveaway, subsidy, whatever you want to call it. So yep.
You basically can arbitrage. This is why any real estate that you own, you should leverage it highly and get those very low, long-term, fixed-rate, investment-grade loans on them and turn them around and, well, buy other properties would be my first choice, additional income properties. But if not, just do hard money lending, because right there, you're just arbitraging. If you borrow that money at, say, 4 or 5%, I mean, investment property loans are a little more expensive, but say it's 4 or 5%, and you can loan it out at 10 or 12% or 11%, you're arbitraging that difference right there. Okay, and that's a beautiful thing. The hard thing about the hard money is, number one, I don't want to do long hard money loans. I want them to be very short, because the longer the loan, the higher your inflation risk. Right. Okay. And there is some real probability we're going to see some significant inflation in the future. Maybe not. I don't know. But one of the things nobody counts in inflation, of course, the official numbers, the consumer price index, is very manipulated. And by the way, just as an aside, that's manipulated in three major ways: weighting, substitution, and
there's a third one.
Hedonics. Yes, hedonics. That's right. Weighting, substitution, and hedonics is the way they manipulate that index and make it look artificially low. But regardless of the consumer price index, there is significant asset inflation, which is not considered in the index, Mike.
That's right.
And this is incredibly significant. You know, if you want to play in the stock market, if you want to play in the cryptocurrencies, if you want to play in real estate, it's far more expensive to get in the game now. And I believe something no one's talking about that is going to have an incredibly significant effect on the future is this. And Mike, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. You look at this millennial generation, okay, Gen Y. I'm a Gen Xer. Well, you're a Gen Yer, actually. I don't know. You might be a Gen Xer.
I was born 1971. What is it? I'm not sure what generation.
No, you're in Gen X. You're a Gen Xer, like me. So anyway, the Gen Y, the millennial generation, the over-entitled younger generation, right, that grew up with technology, for better or worse, they're the largest demographic cohort in American history. 80 million people, slightly bigger than 76 million of the baby boomers. Those million numbers vary a little bit depending on who you're talking to, yeah, but that's the general consensus, okay? So this giant demographic cohort, right, is they're leaving. A lot of them went to college. They have huge student loan debt. They basically have a mortgage without getting a house included. They just get a mortgage only, not a house, because of their student loan debt. They got a college degree in some epically stupid liberal arts thing that nobody's, you know, nobody is hiring for feminist studies, okay? Maybe the government, okay?
Let's just be politically correct. Let's just call underwater basket weaving. It's an exciting degree.
Okay, these degrees are not useful in the marketplace. You want to get a degree in something, go be an engineer. Do something real that actually is, you know, someone's actually hiring for, okay? Otherwise, be an entrepreneur and create value another way in the world. But look, this generation is really largely left out due to asset price inflation. They're left out of the investment game. Now, this is a different class of people I call the investor class. And a lot of these people, they're not going to be in that game for a long time until they maybe inherit money from their parents, or, you know, some of them will be successful and they'll have successful businesses or careers or whatever and make money that way. But, you know, a lot of them, they're just not getting in the game into investing, regardless of the asset class. Okay. You know, when I was in my 20s, a lot of people in their 20s were buying their first home or condo. They're not doing that so much anymore. Okay. And a lot of reason is they just can't. Their prices are so inflated now that it's very hard to get into the investor class. And when you project that out 5, 10, 15, 20 years, Mike, I think that has a significant impact on the economy. I think it's great for real estate investors because a lot of these people will be renters for much longer than normal. And we see the homeownership rate declining, which I actually think is a fine thing. You know, some people are all concerned about that. I don't think the homeownership rate has to be high. I don't think it should be high. I think it hurts the economy in a lot of ways, interestingly. And, you know, that gives us a big market of renters in which to serve. They're our customers. So I love more customers, and most investors do.
Well, that was very insightful. So a couple of things that I picked up from your brilliant speech, and I wanted to add a couple of comments. So number one, my rule number one of real estate investing is this: if the rate of appreciation on your property is higher than the rate on the mortgage, you are well off in the long run.
Not only that, it doesn't have to be higher, because remember, with a mortgage, you get a multiplier. If you put 20% down, you multiply that rate of appreciation times 5. Okay, you know, you get that multiplier
compounding factor.
So 6% appreciation becomes 30% appreciation when it's leveraged.
That's right. But that basic concept is true even in markets like New York, where you don't get much cash flow, but you get the appreciation, and appreciation takes care of that. But one comment on the millennials. So interesting is happening. New construction is booming. There's a new construction boom, and I was reading an article, as a matter of fact, today, that these are phenomenal days for new builders. So new builders are enjoying one of the best times in the market.
Yeah. Yep.
And they're building a lot of rental inventory. Mm-hmm. What's most interesting is a lot of investors coming in and buying new construction investment property for all the reasons that we just talked about. And it's a new property with low maintenance, very financeable. And the consequence is that the market is shifting. A few years back, during the days of the boom and then the bust, who were the buyers? They were all homeowners. Now it's investors. Investors are consuming a lot of inventory. So,
yeah, they sure are.
What do you think about the economy in general? You talked about the CPI, an artificially inflated CPI. What do you think about this? So with this round of tax cuts, we're certainly going to see a boost for the economy. Certainly going to see a lot of benefits to
folks. I mean, listen, folks, this is a giant gift from Trump. I've never been any huge Trump fan because I just think the guy's, he's just weird. What can I say? I mean, he's an odd bird. I don't know if he's brilliant or crazy. I'm not sure. But, you know, he says some stuff that's so ridiculously outlandish. I don't know. But I can tell you one thing I think about Trump. He's going to be phenomenal for the economy. The real estate market, the investor market is getting so much better with this tax bill. The other thing is Trump has said, he's reducing regulation. He wants to repeal or reduce the impact or soften Dodd-Frank, which is this crazy bit of legislation that happened during the financial crisis that just, you know, I'm not saying we didn't need some legislation to come out of that. I think we need to put some crooks in jail. Nobody went to jail. I think you could start with the former head of Countrywide, Anthony Pizzillo, going to jail, and maybe the Wells Fargo guy. I don't know. Everybody at Wells Fargo, I think, should go to jail. They're a bunch of crooks. They have like a scandal every week. But anyway, so that's going to increase the flow of money into real estate, into income-producing real estate especially. And also, there's a big presence of the institutions in that business that we've, we were going to talk about, although I don't think time will permit us to dive into that too much today, Mike. I think we've got good times ahead for quite a while, you know, unless there's something I don't know. I can tell you this, another mortgage crisis is extremely unlikely. The banks have been very conservative. I mean, they are underwriting loans. I think it's overkill. I think they've been way too conservative.
They overcorrected in the underwriting process for sure.
Overcorrected, and we're the banks are not going to get in trouble with the mortgages they've given for the last several years. I can tell you that's pretty safe bet. But we will see. I know we've got to wrap up, Mike, in the interest of time here. But you know, I think we've got good times ahead. I'm very bullish right now.
Yeah, me too. I'm bullish on the economy. What I think we're going to see is some level of accelerated inflation. Both, you obviously mentioned, we've seen a lot of asset inflation. And for a number of years, I was thinking we're going to see sort of stagflation, essentially high inflation and low wage increase. But right. I am convinced today we're actually going to see both wage and asset inflation. And that's going to be good for the economy in general.
Yeah, I mean, Trump has talked about that. You know, he's bringing jobs back to the U.S. And I think the middle class worker is finally going to benefit. I mean, the middle class worker hasn't had a raise in decades, Mike, in real dollars.
Agreed.
It's been just anemic.
Just for the sake of the fairness, I am not a big Trump fan, nor am I. I'm right down the middle. We're both are libertarians. So my family voted.
Well, we've got Ron Paul speaking at my upcoming conference. I know you'll be there, Mike.
Yes, that will be very exciting. Actually, he's one of the most brilliant politicians and one of the most...
he's the only real deal in
politics. Logical people.
Yeah, I agree. Couldn't agree more. So, Meet the Masters coming up in January. We have Ron Paul speaking. So come out and meet him, folks.
For the audience, would you please say your website so the listeners could go to your website and find out about Meet the Masters and other things you do?
Absolutely. It's just my name, jasonhartman.com. That's jasonhartman.com, jasonhartman.com. And for the event that we talked about, jasonhartman.com/masters.
Thank you kindly for all your brilliant thoughts and your feedback and coming on the podcast. I hope everybody has enjoyed this episode with Jason Hartman. Thank you kindly and have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Mike. Happy investing to you and your listeners.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to BigMikeFund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike's slot name. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.